This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. A decade ago, Tom Brokaw wrote about the Americans who fought and won World War II. He called them the greatest generation. The name stuck. The former NBC News anchor does not offer up a simple slogan to describe the generation that came of age in the 1960s. As he notes in his new book, Boom, Voices of the 60s, the times were more complex. The Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, feminism, freer attitudes toward that troika of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Yet, for all of that, Brokaw notes it wasn't just one voice from the left that echoes today. Tom Brokaw spoke about his book and the era in a recent appearance in Los Angeles, and we'll hear him this hour on Word for Word. Tom Brokaw spent 21 years as the anchor and managing editor of the NBC Nightly News. He retired from that role 3 years ago, and in that retirement, he's been writing books and hosting occasional television documentaries as well. Tom Brokaw was just beginning his journalism career in the 60s. He started out in Omaha in 1962, moved to Los Angeles, and then to NBC National News in 1966. Before being tapped for the top job at NBC News, he was host of The Today Show. Interviewing Tom Brokaw November 12th at a town hall forum in Los Angeles was Judy Muller, formerly a reporter for ABC News, who now teaches journalism at the University of Southern California.
So what part of retirement don't you get?
Well, the idea was never to retire, but it was to dial down or shift into a lower gear, and I seem to have missed on both counts. You know, it's hard to just switch it off, it turns out. There was a lot of momentum going all the way back to my Los Angeles days of working every day and chasing the big stories around the world. And then on that fateful December day in 2004, with my decision, I said, I don't want to be in the same place every night at 6:30 wherever I am in the world. The stark reality of my new life came to me the next morning when I got up. Meredith had already typically gone off to play tennis at 7, came back and found me uncharacteristically sitting in the kitchen with my robe having a cup of coffee. And she said, "What are you up to?" And I said, "I'm going to sit here until you fix me lunch." She blew me a kiss and said, "Good luck, big guy," and was out the door. So I thought maybe I'd better find a new way to occupy my time.
So first, the greatest generation. Were you tempted to call this one the greatest in their own minds generation?
Well, a lot of them were very nervous about it because I have a lot of friends who are baby boomers. Gary Trudeau was the first one to say to me, "Are you going to call this one the worst generation?" And I said, "No, I'm not. I don't think you were as great as you thought you were as a generation, nor as bad as other people did." The other day I was talking to John Meacham, who's the editor of Newsweek, and he said, "What kind of a phrase can we use?" And I've still been struggling with it. I said, "How about the provocative generation?" But they haven't entirely left their mark yet. It was kind of the hell-raising generation, I suppose. It was a generation that was the largest, best educated, and most prosperous in the history of mankind. And in a way that generation didn't fully appreciate, I believe, the boomers, their parents had been through so much and made so many sacrifices. They wanted their kids to have everything that they didn't have. And the greatest generation will often say to me, "I think our children are terrific, but we probably spoiled them a little bit."
Mm. I'm a boomer. You're not.
I'm not.
But I sense from reading this book that you're kind of a boomer wannabe.
I would. No,
I mean, you smoked pot?
No, I wouldn't say wannabe. I kind of like the uniqueness of being born in 1940 so that I did remember the war. It was the first experience that I had as a child. I lived on an Army base. The war was all around me. So I had firsthand experience with the sacrifice that was going on in our family and in other families up and down the street and the consequences of war. And then, too, it was fairly thrilling to be a member of a working-class family from very humble circumstances in the Great Plains with my parents who survived the Depression and then watch them manage this new wave of prosperity and begin to form hopes and dreams for their kids that they couldn't have imagined for themselves not that much earlier. I remember I was 10 years old. We bought our first car, first new car in the family. It was $1,750. I remember how much we paid for our first home, my parents, when they bought it. They could have bought it with all cash. They'd saved that much money in 1955. So those left deep impressions on me, and they still form me to this day in a way that the boomers who came along a little later didn't have, I suppose you could say, didn't have the experience of closely witnessing all of that. So I have one foot in the psychedelic waters of the 60s and one foot on the terra firma of the 50s.
And what I love, and speaking of prices, when you were, it was 1968, and you're living here in L.A., you're working for KNBC as an anchor and reporter, and in your book you say you found a home for $42,000, or homes were going for $42,500 in the Valley. Yeah. It's the Valley. Gasoline is 30 cents a gallon. And that was pretty a good sell. You were making what, like $30,000 or something a year?
I was. I mean, and you know, I was making a very good salary because I was doing some anchoring by then. But other friends of mine were, you know, maybe not making quite as much, but we could all afford a home. We went out for dinner on Saturday nights in Los Angeles, and it was maybe $20-$25 for a couple. Things were affordable, it seemed. We sent our children to public school in those days. And, you know, we took you could go out to Burbank Airport. I don't have to tell this audience that. You go out to Burbank Airport, walk on PSA, and a stewardess in a pink hot pants would sell you a ticket for $12 cash.
Oh, those
to
were
go
the
to
days.
San Francisco for the weekend. So it was there were fewer pressures on the boomers as they were coming along. Jan Winter says in the book, you know. We were having a great time, and when we ran out of money, we went down to the post office, and our parents sent us a check. Now, that didn't happen to everybody. I mean, the working-class town, the communities in the inner city, not too far from here, they weren't getting that check from home. So the danger with the 60s always is that you say 60s, and you form a prism that has a flower child in Golden Gate Park and the soundtrack of Simon and Garfunkel playing in the background, Love Beads and Peace and Love. It was much more complicated than that. It was not a still life. It was a collage that was very dynamic in many ways. It had many shades of color to it.
And I like the way you intersperse your personal biography in this with your foot and butt, because you're really an observer. You're sort of like Zelig in this thing. You're at the Chicago Convention. You're at civil rights rallies, you know, you're everywhere. Watts, you came along after the Watts riots of 1960.
But I was deeply involved in it afterwards. The Watts riots happened in 65. I got here in 66, and we had the Little Watts riots. And Leonard Detweiler was killed by a policeman. Some of you will remember that. And I went down to the county courthouse to cover it. And this Rolls Royce pulls up, and a young black lawyer gets out in an all-white suit and says, Tom Brokaw, I've been watching you on television every night. My name is Johnny Cochran, and I am representing the other family. So,
let me ask you, as a reporter who's covered that whole span and through Rodney King, and you've seen what's happened here, Katrina, does it dismay you that our coverage of inner cities, and when I say our coverage, I'm talking about mainstream media, the networks, has not been terribly responsible?
No, I'm not sure I'd use the word responsible. I think it's not been terribly attentive. I think that, too, is complicated. After Katrina and the exposure to the world of the black underclass in New Orleans, and there was great shame in this country and a feeling of guilt, I'm not saying that I was a seer. I think any reporter who's been covering urban affairs for a long, long time knew that those conditions existed. And they exist not just in New Orleans, but around the country. So we had a meeting at NBC about how we would try to attack that. And I said, let's not go back to New Orleans. That's going to get a lot of attention. Spike Lee's film, Brian was there a lot. Everybody was going back in. Let's demonstrate that this is going on everywhere and see if we can't find an interesting city to tell the story. Well, we settled, of all places, on Jackson, Mississippi, because Jackson, of course, was the epicenter of segregation during the 60s, and it was a terrible place for blacks to live. And when we went back down there, we discovered that Jackson now has a black mayor, a black police chief, a black newspaper editor. The most prominent columnist is a black columnist. It has a real black professional and middle class, and all the whites have moved out to the county. And the old black neighborhood called Georgetown is now left with the people who couldn't get out. And crack cocaine has taken over. And Lanier High School in Jackson, which used to be quite a good high school for black students with inferior materials, but a real drive, is now just kind of a holding area. And so I wanted to tell that story so that everybody in America would know that the challenges from here on are tougher than they were then in many ways. And there is a great dialogue going on in the black culture now about what do we do about responsibility within our own culture. It's not just up to the black community. It's up to everyone else. There's a vast criminal empire in this country called the drug culture, and that grew out of the 60s. You know, that great line about, oh, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there, ha-ha. Well, a little recreational drug use from time to time, pretty benign. But in many parts of this country, especially in the urban city, urban metropolitan areas, there is a criminal empire at work, and we have not been able to do much about it. And crack cocaine is destroying a lot of these inner-city neighborhoods. And kids are growing up thinking they can make a faster buck on the corner peddling nickel bags of heroin than they can by going to school. And they get busted, and the white suburbanite who comes in an SUV and buys a weekend's worth of pot does not. So there's a disconnect going on here. Bill Buckley, of all people, says that we ought to legalize marijuana for medical use as a first step because, as he puts it, it's easier for a college student. He says it's easier for a college student to find a joint than it is for a sailor to find a brothel. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars, and we're making no headway.
Some of the bigger divisive issues from the 60s still echo today in our debates about Iraq on down. And I wanted to read you a quote from Andrew Sullivan, who just wrote this in The Atlantic.
And I've been hearing this a lot, actually. Well,
I thought I was going to be the first. Well, maybe you haven't heard it. At any rate, it's he's calling for an Obama candidacy. I mean, he's promoting Obama candidacies. And he says, in this sense, it is a potentially transformational candidacy. Unlike any of the other candidates, Obama could take America finally past the debilitating, self-perpetuating family quarrel of the baby boom generation, a Giuliani-Clinton matchup favored by the media elite. I think that's you, me. Is a classic intergenerational struggle with two deeply divisive and ruthless personalities ready to go to the brink. Giuliani represents that Nixonian disgust with anyone asking questions about, let alone actively protesting, war. Clinton will always be in the minds of so many the young woman who gave the commencement address at Wellesley, who sat in on the Nixon implosion, and who once disdained baking cookies. For some, her husband will always be the draft dodger who smoked pot and wouldn't admit it. She and Giuliani are conscripts in their generation's war. To their respective sides, they are war heroes. And in this sense, this election may be the last big gasp of the baby boomers.
I think that the election of 2008 could very well be, to one degree or another, a referendum on 1968 and the residue of the 60s. I've been going around the country saying it's a time for us to decide what we want to embrace and what we ought to discard or leave behind now. That does not mean that Hillary can't move beyond those debates or that other members of that same generation can't move beyond it as well. This thesis that Andrew Sullivan typically has put quite eloquently and persuasively is much more of a theme in Obama's campaign now. I don't know how it connects to a lot of people because it's more of an intellectual approach, I suppose, but it is helping fuel his stepped-up attacks on Hillary Clinton. I'll share with you some other things from the book. Both Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich, two people that I've often thought were separated at birth because they come from dysfunctional Southern families. They're both prematurely gray. They both have had, women. Depending on your point of view, trouble with women or a great time with them. They're both political junkies. They're both very smart with a great command of political history. Both, each of them in the book, and without me making reference to it, have said essentially the same thing, that the election of 1968 in 2008 will not be an ideological food fight. It'll be an election about solutions. Bill Clinton says that the Republicans will say, we understand that this is an election about solutions. Democrats can't do it. We can. Gingrich, who has turned on his own party in some way, says that the Democrats know what needs to be done in terms of solutions, and they don't have the courage to do it. Republicans can do it, but they're not capable of understanding what needs to be done now because they're worn out. They have no new ideas. And he said, quote, we have a president who knows nothing. So this is going to be in play for the next year, I think. And it's very hard how you then take that to the country. My own strong feeling is that the big issues for this next year will be not in a Vietnam or an Iraq sense, but how do we develop a new paradigm for national security and dealing with Islamic rage, because we've learned that the military response alone is inadequate. We're going to have to find new ways of dealing with this. What are we going to do about health care? What are we going to do about public education? What are we going to do about the drug culture, for that matter?
We're listening to a recent appearance by former NBC Nightly News anchor Tom Brokaw. He spoke about his book, Boom, Voices of the 60s, on November 12th in Los Angeles. You're hearing him on Word for Word from American Public Media. Now, back to moderator and former ABC News reporter Judy Mueller.
Our generation, my generation, I think had this idea that we would be the generation of change. And it's sort of shocking, I think, to a lot of baby boomers that there's this sort of malaise, this kind of clinical depression.
But whose fault is that, Judy?
Pardon me?
Whose fault is that?
It's mine. No. that's a good question.
A big fault of the boomers, and I'm not pointing the finger of blame at them. They didn't stay the course. Those on from the center left, the center right saw the 60s as an opportunity and took it, and organized think tanks and elections. And one, I say in one of the chapter headings, is this what the anti-war activists and the liberal activists of the 60s had in mind? Richard Nixon elected to 2 terms, Gerald Ford serving 2 years as President of the United States, Ronald Reagan serving 2 terms, George Bush, 41, serving 1 term, and George Bush, 43, serving 2 terms. 6 of the 8 elections were won by Republicans. And it wasn't by accident. They saw their opportunity, and they took it and moved in and stayed organized and worried about how they were going to organize their elections. And Ronald Reagan created a new generation of Americans called Reagan Democrats. And those are the facts of history. And that's how we ought to look at the 60s in a more objective way to figure out where we want to go from here, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. The objective reality.
And you look at 1968, particularly the Democratic National Convention in August of that year, and you were a reporter there at the time, as really a seminal turning point, which is interesting because we all think of, you know, Daley's cops, you know, beating on hippie protesters. That's, you know, generally what you come away with. Why did that change politics in this country? Hubert Humphrey was nominated.
More than anything else, the 1968 convention, whatever phrase you want to say, it dismantled the Franklin Roosevelt coalition. The party came apart. My friend Joe Sorrell is in the audience here somewhere, who was very much a member of that coalition and represented and would have breakfast for Hubert Humphrey many times. In 1968, on the streets of Chicago, the coalition that Franklin Roosevelt had put together in 1932 and held through the Depression and World War II and into the post-war years with John F. Kennedy, it came apart on the streets. Labor became disenchanted with the party. The kids abandoned it. A lot of the anti-war activists and the bright young liberals of the time have said to me, now, we made a terrible mistake. We didn't support Humphrey in the fall. And between them, George Wallace and Richard Nixon got 60% of the vote in the fall of 1968. Nixon barely beat Humphrey, less than a percentage point. But 60% of the vote went to right of center and far right of center because the party was unraveling in the streets. When I went back to South Dakota from Chicago on my way back to California, my parents were emblematic members of the FDR coalition. They had grown up in South Dakota and struggled, lost everything in the Depression, fought their way back. My dad worked for the Corps of Engineers on big government projects in the Midwest, building dams. And they thought he was God, and the Democratic Party was their political temple. When I got to Yankton, I thought my dad would be very sympathetic to the kids on the streets because he didn't like the war. But I'll tell you what he hated more. He hated privilege that allowed some students to have deferments. Well, my brother was a Marine in Vietnam. He hated the students using the kind of language they did against cops and burning flags and waving the Viet Cong flag. And we had a murderous argument the night I got back. I mean, it was as difficult a time as my wife has ever witnessed in our family. And when I woke up the next morning with a terrible hangover and still an empty feeling of rage, I thought to myself, this conversation is being repeated across the country. And this is a terrible sign for the Democrats. And in fact, it was typical, I think, of what was going on in a lot of families from a generational point of view. Now the issue is, going into 2008, is whether the Democrats have learned their lessons and whether the Republicans will allow themselves to become the mirror image of the Democrats from 1968. And there's a lot of concern about that. A lot of very insightful Republicans say to me, we have been infected with the same hubris that brought down the Democrats. We've taken power for granted. We've abused it. We've allowed the marginal issues to define who we are. Even Dick Armey, by the way, these days is saying, hey, this country is not just about homosexual rights and about abortion. We've got other big issues that we should be dealing with, but that's where our party is parked at the moment, and we've got to move beyond that.
When you talk about your family and the tension of the time, and I'm sure there are a lot of people in here who have similar experiences and memories of sitting on the dinner table arguing about this, but I'd like to get at the whole issue of how people observe look at the military. When people came back from Vietnam then, of course, there were people calling them baby killers, spitting on them.
Hostile reaction.
That doesn't happen now. And do you think that that is a legacy, one of the better legacies of Vietnam?
No, I think it's a true legacy of Vietnam. When I go around the country, this is a big issue with me because we now have an all-voluntary military. And that means those of us who choose either, A, not to get involved personally or have our children get involved, nothing is being asked of us. We're at war, and there are no sacrifices being required, no extra taxes, no reminder on a daily basis of what other families are going through. And these other families, a lot of them, are working-class families from small towns you've never heard of before. They're paying a heavy price and carrying a heavy burden. You can hate this war, and there's good reason, because so many premises and promises have been broken or unfulfilled. But as citizens, and just from a pure humanitarian point of view, we all have an obligation to these families who are sending their children off to war in uniform to defend this country. And the military can't be like a pickup game in school in which we pick which games we want to play. We've got to have an active military and an active attitude about it. And so I remind audiences, find a way to be in touch with those families and be connected to them. That did not happen in Vietnam. And the people who have made the deepest impression on me in many ways in the book, Judy, are Vietnam veterans because they're more fully resolved somehow.
Jim Webb
and a lot of them. Well, Bob Carey, Chuck Hagel, a lot of them who went through such trauma at a formative time in their lives In many cases, they believed in the war, came back, had second thoughts about it, but then had a hostile reaction back here and learned the real meaning of intolerance. And now they're some of our most distinguished public servants, and they're out there in the fabric of American life. It's a wonderful dialogue between, in a way, between Jim Webb and Colin Powell and Chuck Hagel and Bob Kerry and Richard Holbrooke, who was not in uniform, but he was in Vietnam in 66 as a Foreign Service officer. I hope that that will be a part of the book that a lot of people will pay attention to.
Students today, you've been to Berkeley. Your daughter goes to Berkeley. Yeah. I teach at USC, and we've gotten a lot of defense contracts to develop all kinds of things. And I teach journalism, so I ask my journalism students, do you think there's a story there? You know, is that a conflict? And they just look at me blankly, like, why would that be a problem? And I realize that this is really the generational difference. One kid was going on and on about VC, and I thought, Viet Cong? And he was talking about venture capitalists, and so I... So I get that there's a divide, but why... Is it because there's no draft that there's nobody out in the streets?
The draft has a lot to do with it. For all the proclamations of moral outrage and deep passions about the inequities of the war in Vietnam, when the draft went away, the passion index went way down. And a lot of you in this town, of course, know Mort Saul, who I knew well back then. And I said to Mort in 1969, we were talking about the kids and what was going on. And he said, I think they're a pretty good generation, but he said, what troubles me is that they put a McCarthy bumper sticker on their Volkswagen bus, drive around for 6 months, and when he doesn't get elected, they say, that's it, I'm giving up on the system. And there was something to that. A big piece of it is staying power. Look, I believe one of the profoundly important things that happened in the 1960s that 500 years from now people will look back and say that was truly heroic was the civil rights movement and Dr. King. That had staying power. That had a core philosophy attached to it. It had enormous courage of going in first to make the country aware of it, then getting the Civil Rights Act passed, then getting the Voting Rights Act passed, and staying with the cause until, tragically, he was murdered. But it wasn't just tactics. It was also strategy. It was a long-term plan and keeping the issue in front of us. Carl Pope, who was the head of the Sierra Club, a young man who was at Harvard at the time, speaks very insightfully in the book about the mistakes that they made. He said, we had no adult supervision, in effect. I didn't learn anything from anybody older. Faculty members were like deer caught in the headlamps, and they were romanticized by the book. And Pope tells a story about organizing this big, big protest against Robert McNamara visiting the Harvard campus. And McNamara comes out, gets into his limousine, they surround the limousine, and they throw their bodies down in front of it. McNamara steps out of the limousine and said, okay, I'll debate the war right here and now. And Carl said, we had no one to step forward to debate it. We hadn't thought that carefully or that far ahead. And so these are the lessons that I hope will come out of the book, that in this reunion that people will learn where the mistakes were made, where the excesses were, where the exploitation occurred, and that maybe we can get back to a more common dialogue.
You mentioned civil rights, and I'm thinking of women's rights as well, because feminism was a huge movement in the 60s, starting with Betty Friedan and Ms. Magazine. You interviewed Gloria Steinem and Nora Ephron, many others. And certainly when I went into broadcasting in the 70s, I was one of the only women on radio, because women, and I sound like a guy, which helped, and it just wasn't, nobody believed that women could have credibility. That's changed, and yet here we are, as you know, debating whether a woman can be anchor of a network news show, and I guess the jury is still out on that. But it's, do you think we've made great strides there?
Oh, huge strides, for sure. I think that the next challenge is more vexing. I'm married to a very strong woman and been very successful in business and other aspects of her life. I have three very accomplished daughters who are launched in their careers. Two of them are mothers and they're trying to balance. The next phase of it is this phase. This is the hard part. We now have more than 50% of the law school classes in America are women, the students. Same thing is true in medical school. Business school is slightly below half, but not much below half. So you have these highly trained, really bright young women coming into the workplace. But they have other interests in life, including procreation. And they want to have babies. And they get to be 33, 34, 35. And they want to go off and have a child. And that's how society advances itself.
Well, they don't do it by themselves.
No, I'm not. Let me finish. I understand they don't do it by themselves. But my anecdotal evidence at the offices and with my own kids is that there is something about the maternal bond. And when they go away and they want to stay home for a while, even if the husband isn't home with them because they want to make that connection to their child, they're gone a year or they're gone 8 months. And what happens is that the job closes up behind them. Now, I've been thinking about this a lot. I think it's one of the really vexing problems that we have to face. Our daughter is an emergency room physician in San Francisco. This is not gender-specific or oriented. She has to be there for the shift because there's not much that they can do if she's not there. But she's got two children, and her husband has a big radiology practice in the city. He's a great father. He participates in it all. But Jenny said, there are just things I want to do as a mother to be there.
Well, as a result,
I'm going 18 hours a day, and my generation is bumping up against that. I think in some areas, the Internet will be a godsend, because if you're a lawyer, you can read the briefs at home and do the work, and it's the virtual office space. You can do that in the academy, even. You can do it to some degree in corporations, I think, and there will be more video conferencing. But that's the issue that I don't think that we are joining sufficiently.
My daughter is she's a news producer for Katie Couric, actually, for that show.
Good luck.
Yeah. And this is being taped, so I... but she, and she'll probably hate me for this too, but, you know, she is saying many of the same things. She has a two-year-old and she's expecting another. And you know how it is. You send you off to a story and you don't know when you're coming home. But a lot of what I hear her saying are things that I had to say and worry about. And her husband's very supportive and helps with the baby, but I just wonder, as a society, why we haven't come further in helping young couples do this with childcare, with the kinds of support that women need. I mean, institutionally, it shouldn't be up to these young women to work 18 hours a day, and worry about it all themselves.
And the other issue about it is, Judy, that I think that we have to come to grips with it. For the generation like your daughter and my daughters who are coming along, because they had such unparalleled opportunities, there was a whole new field open to them. It was kind of an open field. They were expected to aggressively take advantage of it and set everything else aside. And a lot of the women that I talk to that show up in this book say, we also got to be able to say to a woman, it's okay to go have your baby and spend four, and it's okay to be a mom. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an honorable thing to raise a... I said the other day to somebody, you know, given a choice between doing one more municipal bond deal and raising a healthy, well-adjusted child, I know where I vote, about what's better for society. And that, too, has been lost in this debate. And there's too much pressure put on young women who say, I'd like to make the choice to go home, and I'd like to stay home for 3 or 4 years without being ostracized by fellow workers or, in some cases, being taken advantage of in their absence. That, too, has not been joined as part of the discussion.
Former NBC Nightly News anchor Tom Brokaw speaking November 12th at Town Hall, Los Angeles. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
At USC, a lot of the young women I teach will start a sentence by saying, well, I'm no feminist, but...
Yeah.
And it's really, that word has taken on terrible connotations for this generation.
Well, in the book, Judith Rodin, I don't know how many of you know who she is. She is a remarkable woman of her generation. Judith Rodin grew up in Pennsylvania, went to the University of Pennsylvania as an undergraduate, got interested in psychology. She was the best and brightest. She went to Columbia to do her graduate work and immediately encountered real gender discrimination from male professors and resident and advisors, PhD advisors, saying, well, you're just going to have a baby. I don't think I want to get involved with you. She stayed the course. She got her degree from Columbia. She went to Yale. She became provost at Yale. Then she was named president of Penn. And she continued to be a very popular faculty member at Yale. And so she had a party for her best and brightest students, male and female, as she was going off to Penn. The guys all said, oh, Dr. Rodin, we just loved having you as our professor. The women all said, we don't want to lead your life. It's too hard. We've been watching. And we want a more measured or tempered life. She said, that was stunning to me. I thought I was the real role model for the women. But in their eyes, I was overwrought in some ways. So I had to think about balance in my life. Judith has been married 3 times, had only 1 child, and she said, you know, there are consequences for this, for driving yourself through your career. And we don't have an appropriate common set of languages for dealing with a lot of that.
I'm just curious, and in terms of women in broadcast journalism, I mean, you've one of the 3 big guys for a long time. Have you seen many changes there? Do you still see women struggling?
All the key personnel that I have working for me are women. It's a little unique because I have the flexibility now to say to women who wanted to go off and have a child, can you give me 2 months next fall and we'll work on a project together? And we do that. I'm in the midst of something now for the History Channel, a documentary, 2 hours. I knew exactly who I wanted. Liz Fisher, who was spending some time at home, I said, Liz, come on back. She's been working very hard. Her husband's a neurosurgeon in New York. And in about 2 weeks, she'll go back home again for a while. I understand that's anomalous. But I do see a rising tide of women. It's frankly, in most of these organizations, the women are the ones who are the best and most reliable workers because they're getting opportunities that they don't take for granted, that the men did for a long, long time. They bond with each other and help each other more. But yes, it's still a male-dominated thing. Let me just say something about Katie, which everybody refers to. This is a complex situation. Katie developed a personality mostly in the morning. She was enormously popular. There was no question that she was one of the most skilled people I've ever seen in broadcasting. And we talked before she went off to do the CBS Evening News. And the night that she called me to say that she'd made the decision, which I was not surprised by, I said, I don't blame you. It's a dive off the high board. And she said, are you saying I'm going to fail? And I said, no, but I've done both shows. And it was a tough adjustment to go from the Today Show to Nightly News, not for me, but for the audience, because they bring certain perceptions to the job. Katie arrived at CBS News when, in fact, the division was not as competitive as ABC and NBC were in terms of correspondence and resources and what they were willing to commit. Moreover, she came with the determination to change the style and the tone, just at a time when this country was really paying attention in the 2006 election to serious issues. So it was kind of a perfect storm blowing against her, if you will, at that time. And then you can talk, you know, some about how the publicity campaign was organized and how much attention she got for all that. So I don't think it was as much gender-specific as it was how this formulation works out. I know lots of guys who I've always thought should have been huge successes as anchormen. I'll tell you a good example. Forrest Sawyer, I think, is a really skilled...
Where is Forrest?
He's up in Santa Barbara. And he's had lots of opportunities, but it's never, ever quite gelled for him in a way. He's a very talented reporter and a really skilled broadcaster and a really resourceful guy. I did it for a long time. I did it here. I did it at the national level. I never understood what entirely made it work.
I guess what I'm, and I don't want to belabor this because I want to get on to sex, drugs, and rock and roll, which are so important. But I think part of the Katie Couric issue for me is that the men who make these decisions are still putting women in those top spots for traits that aren't necessarily journalistic. And there are an awful lot of strong women reporters out there who are never considered because they're not glamorous or they don't have the Q rate factor or whatever it is. Do I sound bitter? But you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, but I do think that there still is that, if you will, stereotyping that goes on. But Lara Logan, for example, is a really courageous reporter at CBS and does some of the most resourceful reporting in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Is also a very glamorous figure on the air. Campbell Brown, who worked for us, is now getting a new show on CNN. So the sea change is going on. It's slower than any of us would have liked. I always believed that when Dan, Peter, and I went away that there would be a woman who would come in. Katie came in. Would it have, if they had decided to put Diane Sawyer in the evening news at ABC instead of Charles, how would she have done? I think pretty well, frankly. I think that the stuff that she's done in the last couple of years in Iran and Korea and her show, that people take her seriously. But again, you know, it's always hard to know what makes it work. I've heard my friend Meryl Streep complain about the same thing in movies. The guys get the big bucks. And with the exception now, I guess, what, of Julia Roberts, she's the one who can open a movie and women can't as successfully. And here's Meryl, who's one of the most skilled actresses in the history of the thespian arts. She's doing okay, but, you know, it's an issue. It's tough.
Yeah. Okay, drug, sex, and rock and roll.
Okay, pick out which one you want me to talk about.
The pill made a huge difference.
Huge difference.
It was a brief window, but, pretty amazing because it was free love, and this was pre-AIDS, so there was that sense that we could have it all, and there were no consequences.
Sure, but we also, David Smith, who ran the free clinic in San Francisco, was a very liberal guy, said the hard fact is when I went into those communes in Haight-Ashbury, the sexually transmitted diseases was reaching epidemic proportions because people weren't taking personal responsibility or thinking about the consequences of things. And that often happens when you have the kind of eruption that we had in the 60s. The pendulum will swing way too far before people are able to kind of calibrate the effect of it. But the pill had an enormous impact on this country in terms of how people lived together, how they had physical activities with each other. We used to have women's dorms and men's dorms with hours. That changed. And then you throw the pill into
the
equation.
They're in the same dorms.
They're in the same dorms in the same rooms, frankly.
The music.
The most enduring part of the 60s, of which there's almost no dispute, is the music. Republican, Democrat, conservative, libertarian, Maoist.
We're the best.
Everybody loves the music. I went to a James Taylor concert in New York last year, and one of the most conservative people I know in New York came in coat and tie, and I said, he said, I hate his politics. I love his music. I think there's a lot of that out there. I interviewed Bruce Springsteen for the documentary for the History Channel in Chicago recently, and we were talking about that time span, and he said, look, I broke out in 1972. Here I am in Chicago, and I'm on a 39-week tour, and we're going to sold out all across Europe and all across this country. He said, back it up. He said there was no artist who started in 1932 who was still very popular in 1972. Sinatra didn't come along until, the early 1940s. So that is one of the enduring legacies of the 60s, and it's worth celebrating. Judy Collins put it best, I thought. She said, I said, what was unique about the 60s in the music? She said, we were telling our stories in song, personal stories, and people wanted to hear them. James says that my life played out in front of a generation and people reacted to that. Paul says, we went from the piano as an instrument to the portability of the guitar. Everybody could carry one around, so it was a unifying instrument for folks, the guitar. And the other difference was, between then and now, is that every radio station in America in the 60s had a local disc jockey and their own playlist. So you had your favorite disc jockey on your favorite station, and when the new records came in, they would play them. Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant runs 18 minutes and 20 seconds long, or as he likes to point out, the exact length of the gap in the Nixon tapes.
So plans for the next book? Another generation? Are you out of generations?
Well, I'm going to give you a line about parenting that I think a lot of you will be able to identify with. I actually love the boomers. I think they are so skilled. I just think they need to get their act together a little more and start moving in a direction that they can settle on. But the boomers, more than any other generation in the history of this country, certainly, or any society that I know of, absolutely rejected everything that their parents stood for and refused to acknowledge what their parents had been through, the Depression and World War II, because they were oblivious to it. They rejected their values. They rejected their sense of authority. They rejected a lot of their institutions. They rejected even the marital contract. Then those boomers became parents. And they became the overwrought generation of parents. They hired SAT tutors, and they sent them to kabuki camp and soccer camp and music camp. They went to the principal if their kids didn't get into the first choice of schools as quickly as they could. They have this phrase called helicopter pilots. They hover over them, and they pass that along to other generations. That's part of the boomer generation. The other part of the boomer generation, frankly, is that divorce, which had been a kind of a scandal in American society, suddenly became no fault. And we had phrases like starter marriage. Let's just make a quick pass at this. If it doesn't work out, we move on. The consequences were the kids were left behind. And as I go around college campuses now, a lot of these deans and presidents will say to me when I ask them about the millennia generation, what are they interested in? They said they're interested in personal relationships, because they went through so much trauma at home that they don't want to experience that again or put their own children through it.
That sounds like a fairly blanket verdict, and yet in your book you really come out saying the verdict on the 60s is still out.
Yeah, it is. There's so much good that came out of the 60s. Just start with civil rights. If you're an African American, the difference between your life now and the early 1960s is profound. We have a black professional class in this country and a black middle class in this country. And however you feel about the politics, we had a black Secretary of State and we have a black woman who's Secretary of State. We have a black woman, an African-American woman, who's the president of Brown University. So things have changed profound. I was in a meeting the other day with Judith Roden and Ellen Futter, who runs the Museum of Natural History, two of the most accomplished women in New York, running these huge institutions. So a lot of things have changed for the better. And some things are not noticed as much. We have a whole entrepreneurial class that came out of the 60s because they learned as young people how to organize, and they were good at it, and they were well-educated, and they didn't want to go stand in line at IBM and be told in paternalistic fashion, it'll be your turn in 25 years. Silicon Valley is built, in effect, by boomers or people who watched the 60s and learned from that. And that's all good. Fathers are better parents now than they were before that in the 50s. Fathers were more distant figures, and they'd come up in a different way. They're now much more partners with their wives. So there are lots of things that we've made enormous progress on. But what I hope to do in the book is to just have people take stock of where we need to get to next and have a real dialogue about it, a real conversation about it. One of the big points that I make in the book is that when it comes to race, for example, we had more common language in the 50s than we do now. It's become freighted with political correctness and an inability to honestly express a lot of things that we know that need to be said. And it goes on in all aspects of American life, in the white community, the black community, and all the other ethnic communities. We need to lift it up out of that and find a way to have an honest conversation with each other about it and not be afraid to talk about it. I have two very close African-American friends in New York. One of them particularly is a physician. And we have the most candid conversations in the most reasonable possible way about race. And it's, you know, it's good for me and it's good for him, and he talks about it. I watched him one night. I took him, we went to a Knicks game together, and Chris Rock was in this VIP area, and my friend went up to him and said, "You're a really funny young man, and I just love watching you." And Chris kind of pulled him. He said, "Well, thank you very much." He said, "I'm tired of the N-word. My friend is my age." He said, "I grew up with it, and I hated it. And you don't know what it means. It opens up wounds for me." And he said, "You're overusing it. Using it for effect is one thing." And then we spent the first half of the game, Eddie, my friend, and I, did talking about that. And at halftime, Chris Rock came over to him, and he said, "Hey, brother, I got to talk to you about that some more. I want to hear more about that." Well, it's that kind of conversation we don't have enough, frankly.
Former NBC Nightly News anchor Tom Brokaw. His new book is Boom, Voices of the 60s. He spoke in November at Town Hall, Los Angeles, with former ABC News reporter Judy Muller, who now teaches journalism at the University of Southern California. If you missed part of this hour's program with Tom Brokaw, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may do so by visiting our website. It's wordforword.org. In addition to hearing this week's show, you may subscribe to our free weekly podcast and listen to any of our previous programs, including speeches by Newt Gingrich, Bill Clinton, and Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Penkava. Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. And the technical director is Sam Keenan. American Public Media.